Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
For that long intro music. We're having a little bit of a technical challenge today, so thank you for hanging in there with us. So what we're trying to do here on Connecting Faith is bring the mind of Christ to bear on the matters of the day. And so I thought today I would pick a headline that may not be burning up the headlines where you're living, but it's actually a rising and brewing controversy in particular parts of the culture, and it gives us an opportunity to have a conversation about words and the meaning of words. So here's the headline. Clean meat ignites a war of words as food made in labs enters the market. So apparently the traditional meat industry is objecting to the term clean meat being used for products that are made by replicating animal cells. And, you know, so you might think about that which is replacing the real thing in terms of not only meat, but other conversations related to this are things that are sold as mayonnaise that apparently are not actually poultry-based, and things that are marketed as milk that are not dairy-based. And so these are actually large conversations in the food industry. And so here are a couple of paragraphs from the article. Again, the article, Clean Meat Ignites a War of Words as Food Made in Labs Enters the Market. So if meat is grown in a lab without actually slaughtering an animal, what should it be called? That question has yet to be decided by regulators. For the moment, it is pitting animal rights advocates and others against cattle ranchers in a war of words. Supporters of the science are embracing, quote, clean meat, to describe meat that is grown by replicating animal cells, but there's no actual animal involved. So many people in the conventional meat industry are, you know, well, frankly, they think that their word is being co-opted and stolen, and that's not meat. They're also suggesting that when animal cell replicators producing a product in a lab that they are marketing as clean meat implies that traditional meat is, well, dirty. And that has the National Cattlemen's Beef Association Director of Government Affairs, Danielle Beck, frankly, pretty frustrated. So this spat shows the power of language as new industries attempt to reshape eating habits and how what we eat is grown and delivered to us. So there's actually a $49.5 billion beef, poultry, and pork industry here in America, and obviously they want to mobilize to lay claim to the term meat. Squabbles over language are erupting across the food industry as established definitions for everything from milk to mayonnaise are also challenged by, you know, vegans and those who like to drink things that are made of almonds and those kinds of things. So there you go. So I'm at the General Assembly meeting of the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, and yesterday I actually had lots of conversations about the meaning of words, in particular the meaning of the word evangelical. So these evangelicals here at the EPC General Assembly may or may not be the kind of evangelicals that you think of when you think of the term evangelical. So what does the term mean, and who gets to define it? We've actually talked about that a fair number of times, and I thought this would be a good opportunity, using a current headline of the day, to revisit the conversation about nomenclature, the meaning of words. Think about the meaning of the word Christian. What does it mean, and why does it mean that to you, and what does it mean to other people? How about the word family? The word family is certainly being redefined in our culture. The New York Times full-page story over the weekend about, you know, the redefinition of a trans family. You can imagine the kinds of things that were in that article and how family is being sought to be redefined. But that leads us to a conversation about the definition of the word gender or the definition of marriage. How about the word life? That's a word that is often defined in ways that defy its traditional meaning or definition. So how about words like truth or love or sin? Who gets to define these terms? And what do we do when traditional understandings of a word are culturally redefined to mean something that's actually quite the opposite of what the words once meant? And as Christians, what do we do when God's word is represented to mean things that, well, frankly, it was never meant to mean? So I think that in both the church and the culture, we aren't having all the conversations that we need to have about the meaning of words and how words have been repurposed both in the church and in the culture in a myriad of ways. So the reason that we need to have the conversation is because language matters. Language is actually the basis of communication, and communication matters if, as people, we're going to be a people in any meaningful way. So consider for a moment the importance of what we might term common language, a shared understanding of the meaning attached to words. If you and I are using the same words, but we're meaning something very different by them, then we're actually not communicating. The communication cycle is being interrupted because what you mean by the use of a word and by what I mean by the use of the same word is different. And so we're missing actually communicating with one another. So as Christians, we're actually people of the word. Before anything was, God spoke. And throughout history, God has spoken. Ultimately, the word became flesh to dwell among us, full of grace and truth. And the book of Hebrews opens in the past. God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things and through whom he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his what? By his powerful word. Words matter. And no words matter more than the word of God. So I guess I'm wondering how we think we can communicate if we don't actually have a shared understanding of the meaning of the words that we're using. And how we communicate, whether or not we speak the truth in love or support the truth by making it beautiful. So how we communicate either strengthens or weakens the ties that bind us together as a people, in our families, in our culture, in our church. And there are certainly efforts in both the church and the culture to redefine and repurpose particular words based on what we might think of as like reimagining realities that are impossible to align with the original meaning of the word. And the result is that people think they are communicating when in fact they're being manipulated and or mastered. So when we think about this process that's underway in our culture to redefine and repurpose words, I want you to know that it's happening intentionally. There's an intentional effort on the part of some to co-opt and redefine particular words. Family would be one of them. Gender would be another. So would love. So would marriage. These are intentional efforts. It's not happening by accident. It's happening intentionally. And so what does it look like for you and I to reclaim, reinforce, restate the traditional meaning of these words based on a genuinely Christian worldview? How can marriage and the modern family be defined according to God's design for human life and human families? And how can we do that in a way that not only speaks the truth, but does so in love? Is it possible? My answer here is going to be no, by the way. Is it possible for marriage and the modern family to be redefined to include couplings and groupings that God never intended? How about words like equality and justice? These are once celebrated These terms once celebrated the reality that, yes, all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. However, today, equality and justice are used to advance very different ideas. So I want us to be paying attention to words and the way words are used and the way words are being redefined by those around us. And then to ask yourself, are they intentionally redefining that word? What do they mean when they say it? And can I stop long enough in conversation to actually ask someone what they mean? What do you mean when you use the term family? What do you mean when you use the term sin? What do you mean when you use the term church? What do you mean? If we spend enough time learning what people mean by the words they're using, then we might actually begin communicating more effectively with one another. So remember, words matter, and no words matter more than the Word of God. And so one question to be asking ourselves is, how carefully are we handling the Word of God? I'm Carmen LaBerge. I look forward to continuing this conversation with you today. In just a moment, or next up, we're going to be talking with Hannah Brinchner. She is the author of a new book, Come Matter Here. It's your invitation to be here in a getting there world. I'm Carmen LaBerge, and you're listening to Connecting Faith.
Hey friends, we're back. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You are listening to Connecting Faith. Thank you for joining me today. I hope you're having a blessed day and you're experiencing the blessings of God wherever you are. And I hope you are living a being here life and talking with us here today about what it means to be here in a getting there world is author Hannah Brinchner. You might know Hannah from other things that she has written. In fact, a movement that she ignited about helping us return to a love letter writing world. Her new book is Come Matter Here. And Hannah, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So I love some of the one-liners that I pulled from the book, and I thought I would just pitch them up to you and let you, hit them out of the park. So
okay.
If I were to say someday, somewhere is a dangerous game, what would you say?
Yeah, I think that is something like my generation, but I think kind of everybody struggles with, unless you've had kind of you're a pro in this area, but it's always thinking like, oh, if I just get there, then I'll be happy, then I'll be fulfilled, then I'll feel like I've made it or I matter, whatever that looks like. And so if we're always living in that someday, somewhere, when I like myself or when I'm skinnier or when I have more money, then life will really start. I think we miss out on the here and now, and we miss out on like living our lives right where we are and realizing that this really is all that we get.
So why don't you tell people sort of why you wrote this particular book? Like, what was the motivation to write this?
I walked through it in my own life of realizing that I was always waiting to get to the next best thing. And, like this form of success or that form of success or that big move. And the hole just seemed to be growing bigger and bigger inside of me, even with every accomplishment of realizing, like, stopping and looking around and realizing like, whoa, maybe this isn't where I should put all of my eggs into this basket. And maybe this isn't going to fill me. And there's got to be something more to this, because if I'm always striving to get there, wherever there is, I really found myself missing out on just life in the moment. And I learned a lot of this by going through a pretty deep depression that really forced me to look at my life and kind of rebuild what I like to call a new normal that involves having roots and having community and having all of these things that take longer to build and really require you to like be present and show up to everyday life.
So I love that. I would, I would call that like the ministry of presence or recognizing and keeping the divine appointments that God has set, like all that stuff that we encounter in sort of our, the regular run-of-the-mill life that actually is God's intent for the way we live for him in this day. So talk about this in terms of like, you are talking about the regular stuff of life and actually experiencing the regular day to day as something extraordinary.
Yeah, because I think if we're always just living for like those mountaintop moments, as you might call it, like what happens in the in-between? Like there's so many in-between days where there isn't fireworks and there's not something big to announce. And so it can't always just be living in the space of you're on a high or you're at your lowest point. Like there has to be this ability to just kind of walk and live in everyday life. And like where God meets us every single day in that. But like, do we see it for the miracle that it actually is? Or do we just wait to get to the next notable thing, the thing that makes it feel like being here matters, you know?
Yeah, I do know. I liked, in particular, I liked how you talk about, you know, life is not like always a reel, let me think about like a movie reel of perfect beauty, instant success, and constant applause. I felt like, Hannah, you know, that part of the challenge there is how we define beauty or how we let the world define us by particular definitions of beauty, or how we let the world define success and how we let the world define applause versus like, I mean, I feel like I live for constant applause, but it's always the applause of one. So, you know, as long as I'm, as long as I'm satisfying the audience of one in heaven, I'm feeling pretty good. So talk about the challenge that I think we face in our culture, related to the world's definition of beauty, success, and that which is praiseworthy.
Yeah, I think especially living in a world like right now, like we're in an interesting time where like social media is just in everything. And like we use social media so much to announce things and to tell people what we're doing. And it's kind of hard to say like or to see like how you can go through daily life without affirmation and applause when any time that you put something online, like you garner that applause, like you get that approval of other people. And so I have found, like, in my own life, in my own faith, like, that was a harder line to walk and a longer journey to get to the place where I'm like, okay, like, I get my sense of worth from God, and God informs, you know, what I need to do with my day and what success really looks like. You have to be willing to give up that alternative, and that alternative is kind of living for other people. You know, it says right in the scriptures, like you can either live for people or you can live for God, but like you can't please both at the same time. And I think it's something that's really like challenged me to say like, man, I want to be living for God, but in order to do that, I have to give up this need to be known and seen by other people and to have them say you're doing okay. And like, this matters. And this is a form of success, because the world standard of success looks a lot different from what I think we see and recognize success to be through faith.
So in the applause for this book category, friends, if you were to go to the Amazon page for Come Matter Here, Your Invitation to Be Here in a Getting There World, you would see that readers give this a 5 out of 5 stars. Like, you've gotten nothing less than 5-star ratings on Amazon for this book. So the world has applause for what you're saying, Hannah, in this book. And just because I do think it's helpful for people to like hear what other people are saying about things. Let me just, I know this will embarrass you, but to my listeners, let me just say, like, this is what Amazon readers are saying. They're saying, this is a beautiful book. I read it cover to cover. I underlined so many parts and I can't wait to share it with others. Somebody else says, you know, I took my time with this book because I didn't want to rush through it. And you spoke so much into my life. There were gut check moments and me too moments and moments of realization and moments of clarity. This book came into my life at just the right time, beautifully and honestly written. Hannah's message is one that I needed, and it's a message of hope and belonging. So what are you going for in this book? You know, as an author, you know, sort of what's the target you're trying to hit?
I think I'm just trying to hit the target that I think I learned throughout the process of really living this story, is that if we're always waiting to get to this place where we think that it matters, we're going to miss something. We're going to look back and realize that like something was missing. And so I just want people to know that they matter here and now, and that the work that they're doing matters and the place that they're in matters, even if it's not the most favorable place. Like, even if they're like, yeah, I don't really want to stay in this city, or I don't want to, like, this isn't exactly my favorite season of life. Like, there's purpose in everything. if we are willing to see it and we're willing to dig deeper. And what I want for people is to just really learn to do something that I learned to do, but something that I'm continually learning to do, is that when it gets hard and when we face something hard, we don't just pack the suitcase and run, you know, literally and metaphorically, because I think we all face hard things internally in our lives that we can either choose to deal with and walk through, or we just kind of shove it to the side or shove it into a closet in our mind and we don't deal with it. But like, I don't know, I think it's not easier to walk through that stuff, but it makes us stronger and more resilient when we choose to stay rather than bolt when it gets hard.
So I know there's people listening that are huge fans, and I want to say to them, yes, I have some copies of the book. So you can call us in the studio, 877-93-FAITH. If you're a Hannah Brencher fan and you would like a copy of Come Matter Here, or if this just sounds like a book that, man, would bless your life, if you actually want to say, you know what, I want to be here in a getting there world. I want to get off the hamster wheel and actually, mm-hmm. as Hannah would say, be where my feet are. So you guys can call for a drawing for the book. We've got a few to share with you. And again, it's 877-93-FAITH, or you can always email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. So Hannah, let's talk about that one line, be where your feet are.
Yeah, that became my motto a few years ago, particularly in a space where I was ready to move. I was ready to leave. I was done with the space that I was in, and I was really praying, like, God, like, what's next? You know, and I'm thinking God's going to, like, deliver some sign and just have some kind of roadmap for me, which I think everyone that's, like, been in faith, you know, like, you wonder, like, when is that roadmap showing up, you know? And so I remember specifically praying, like, for some kind of sign. And not even a few minutes later, I got an email from a reader, and it was this longer email about how she and her roommates realized this was their last year of college. This was the last time they were ever going to live together in such close quarters. And so they adopted this mentality of be where your feet are. And that was their kind of MO. That was the thing that they just spread to one another. And so I kind of adopted that in my own life. It's like, be where your feet are. And I took that to be a sign from God that he wasn't telling me, like, hey, you need to know what's going to happen a year from now or 5 years from now. You don't even need to know where you need to be right now. I just need you to be right where you are, and I'm going to reveal the next step. And then you're going to take the next step, and I'm going to reveal again right where you are and what's the next step to take.
Hannah Brenchner, thank you so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith. Friends, the book is Come Matter Here. You can check it out online. You can, Hannah is, she's a delight to visit with, and she's also responsive to you. And so I'd encourage you to reach out. If you want a copy of the book, you can call us in the studio, 877-93-FAITH, or email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. This is Connecting Faith, and I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back.
You said, I'm right here, I'm right here. Oh, don't you know I'm here?
No, hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. And, you know, some days we just have the opportunity to sit down with what I call the surprise guest, and I have one for you today. So we didn't even advertise in advance that Craig Strickland was going to be here with us, but Craig is the founding pastor of Hope Church Memphis. He's technically retired, but God's clearly not done with him yet, and so he's got some exciting ministries that he is now engaged in. And I wanted to have him share with us today not only about really the incredible pastoral succession transition that they've made here at Hope Church in Memphis, but also about the ministry that he's involved with now, which you can check out at Echo, ECHO, clinics.org, echoclinics.org. Craig, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Carmen. Wonderful to be here.
So I should say on air, thank you for sharing your office with me this week. It was awfully nice of you to let me set up a little studio here in your office.
It's the DNA at Hope. This is what we do.
It is. And so for our listeners who, you know, would have no reason to be familiar with Hope Church Memphis, share with them what this church is all about and why it's unique.
Okay. Hope's a church that I started with my wife and two other couples about 30 years ago. And at the time I turned it over to my successor, it was in attendance the largest Presbyterian church in the country, which is exciting. I don't take the credit for that. I just happened to show up, and so did God, and he did a miraculous work, which was great fun to be a part of. And from the very beginning, that was 1988, it was the beginning of the church growth movement, and churches like Willow Creek and Saddleback were in their early years as well. And over time, what we determined, or actually discovered, was that people in the South are not unchurched. They're not people that have never been to church. In the South, everybody's been to church. So what we did discover, however, was that there were scores of people who had given up on church. They hadn't given up on God, but they had given up on church. And we went after those people, and we tried to create a church for people that had given up on church. And it worked. And it's been a great journey. And several years ago, the leadership looked up and said, "Will you help us figure out what we're going to do when you step down or retire?" And that set in motion a study that led to what has been for us a very successful transition.
All right, so it's radio, so people can't see you, and they might not be able to discern that you're not really an old white guy, but you're kind of an old white guy.
That's right. I am very much an old white guy.
So Memphis is not an old white guy town.
No.
So talk with us about your heart for this city and the kind of transition in pastoral leadership you were committed to and what that process was like.
It's a great question, Carmen. And when I have thought about Hope Church over the years, and I grew up in Memphis, so I know the city very well, it has a dark history in the years surrounding the death of Dr. King. And what we have discovered in these years after that is that racism in Memphis, Tennessee has not gone away. It's gone underground. And every time there's some sort of problem, everybody blames government and industry, and they're always blaming the police or somebody else on the problem. And I have said from the pulpit for 25 years that racism isn't the problem of government. It's the problem of the church. The church is supposed to be about racial reconciliation. I mean, we're supposed to know something about reconciliation. That's what we're supposed to teach.
It's our ministry.
It is.
I mean, we've been given the ministry of reconciliation.
That's exactly right. And yet somehow we close our eyes to what that means racially. So from the very beginning, we determined that we were going to be a church that was sensitive to that whole issue, and we were going to be a leader in our community. And so as the church grew, we had many, many ministries that were in the city, about the city, and yet our church was still a predominantly white church. And so when the leadership asked me to help them think through succession, I said, I think there are a couple things we need to do that churches normally don't do, which is why I think they fail at succession, one of which is not protecting the new pastor. And so he has to go it alone. And my suggestion was that they keep me around a little bit so that I could defend the new guy. And I said, the other thing is the new guy needs to be African-American. And although some of the leadership was African-American, a lot of people were surprised by that. And I said, think about it. Pray about it a couple of months, and we'll talk again. And when they came back to the person, they said, you're right. Our community has changed. It was all white when we built all of these buildings. And now it's probably 50-60% African-American. We need to reflect our community. And so we looked hard and found a wonderful pastor who is African-American from Houston. His name's Rufus Smith. He's a brilliant guy in his own right. And we hired Rufus. And so that allowed us to tell the city, we will lead in this area. We're willing to be leaders in this need for racial reconciliation in our city.
So one of the wonderful experiences of being here at Hope, first of all, is just the experience of genuine hospitality. I suspect that somewhere that's a core value of who you guys are, because there's just it every single Hope person and you guys, it's no small thing to host a General Assembly meeting for a big denomination. It's just no small undertaking for a local church to do. And so, you know, I got to tell you, the offer of every person in this place that's wearing a purple T-shirt, which seems to be the Hope color, has been extraordinary. And Rufus has, you know, he's out there in the hallways and he's greeting people and he's just as much a part of sort of the welcoming and hospitality process as anybody else. But it's unique. Like, there's a unique experience here on this campus. There are people of lots of different skin pigmentations, but there are also people of lots of different ages and stages of life. And I think that's a surprise to people coming from across the country to a church in Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's very much who we are and who we want to be. But the idea of service, we call it incredible service, is part of our DNA. And so it starts from the top and goes all the way down.
Right. So I might embarrass you by asking you this question, but I really want people to hear this story. Who is Terry Fleming?
Oh, this is I preach about twice a year at Hope. I don't preach here anymore at much at all. Anytime they ask, but it's usually a couple, four times a year. And a couple months ago, I was preaching one Sunday morning, and that afternoon I got an email from this woman named Terry Fleming. She says, I've never been to your church before. Frankly, God told me to come, which was unique in itself that she would say that. And she said, you were talking about a new building that opened downtown and how proud Memphis is of it. And I'm embarrassed because I have a retail shop in that business selling nuts and confections, and I wasn't there. And I'm ashamed I wasn't there because I'm defeated. I've spent all my money and all my product. I got nothing to show for it, and I need some spiritual advice. And I did something I can't ever remember doing in my career. I picked the phone up and called her and said, Terry, this is Craig Strickland. She said, the guy that preached this morning? And I said, yeah. And I said, would you mind telling me your story? And she told me her story, how a single African-American mom who started this business on a shoestring has not paid herself in 2 years in this business, is struggling to know whether to stay alive. And she was meeting the next day with the real estate agent. I said, do you mind if I come to that meeting with you? And she said, no, that'd be fine. And when I transitioned out of my role of senior pastor, I started a nonprofit with my sons and two or three friends. And the goal was to take minority-owned businesses that couldn't fit the credit box. They wouldn't be able to borrow money from a bank and adopt them, put a mentoring group around them, and help them succeed. So I sat through the meeting where she was asking the guy if she could get out of her lease, and he said, yeah, he's a great guy. He said, yeah, but we'd rather you survive. We'd rather you stay and survive. And I introduced myself to him and said, look, we'd like to help her. And I said, can you give us some grace? And he said, yes. So we left that meeting and went back to her little shop, and I said, make me a grocery list. And she made a grocery list, and I went to the grocery store and bought $800 worth of nuts that day. And I came back, and we made and sold nuts all day long. Next morning, I came in at 7 with her and said, do we need more stuff? And she said, yes. And I said, make me a list. She made me a list, and I went out and bought $700 more in nuts of various kinds. And came back, and we worked all day. And for about probably 3 weeks, we worked 6 hours a day, at least 12 hours a day. I did. I hadn't worked that hard ever. I said at first I hadn't worked that hard since I was in college, and somebody said, Craig, you've never worked that hard. And I thought, man, that's probably closer to the truth. And she was coming in before me and leaving after me, and And I got our group together, and we made her a small business loan of about $50,000 and said, we're going to stay with you through this process. And she has become a very dear friend. And I don't work down there anymore. That wasn't the goal. My goal wasn't to sell nuts. My goal was to give somebody their hope back. And the crazy thing is people would come by there and look at me and recognize me and go, so this is it now in your retirement? You sell nuts for a living? And I would tell them the story. And a half a dozen people came through and said, could I volunteer? And they volunteered those first couple of months. So that's the spirit of Hope. I just was doing what we've done for 30 years here at Hope.
So, friends, if you're listening right now and you have wondered to yourself, like, okay, when Carmen talks about the ministry of reconciliation, when the scriptures talk about what it means to walk out the faith into the reality of the world, when we actually talk about coming alongside one another long enough and significantly enough that folks can actually then learn to stand on their own and to take strides on their own, this is what we're talking about. This puts flesh on the gospel, and this puts hope in human hearts. And so one of the reasons I wanted to talk to Craig today was because people just need to hear inspiring stories that are real and true, and people are going to love it. I guarantee you, people listening to this and they're saying, okay, that guy was the pastor of the biggest Presbyterian church in the country in terms of attendance. And, like, he's out there with an apron on selling nuts 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, because that's what it looks like to actually walk your faith out in the community where you live in a substantial way. And even your ability to ask the property owner for some grace is different than Terry Fleming's ability to do so as a single African-American woman.
Absolutely.
And so, friends, when we're talking about whatever resources God has placed within your reach, and we talk about the privilege of position, and we talk about what it looks like to be ministers of reconciliation today, this is it.
And you know, Carmen, one of the things Terry told me early on when we had a couple of those meetings with people in positions of power, she said, Craig, you're at the top of the food chain. You're an older white man, and you get deference I never get. And I said, I know that's true. So one of my roles with you is to be the one who can bring truth to power. And so when you've got a meeting, you got to meet guys like that, call me. Let me meet with you, with them. I think there are all kinds of ways like that that we can walk out our faith. That, you know, that particular one has nothing to do with me being the senior pastor of a large church. You know, I could have been totally retired and just walked in and said, I want to help you. And the actual influence that a story like that has on the hundreds of people that come through there and buy nuts is overwhelming. And, you know, I think the biggest piece of it, whether it's a guy that led a big church or you're a housewife, is I have to get my ego out of the way and swallow my pride and recognize I'm nobody. I'm just one of God's people, and I'm no better than anybody else. So if somebody needs some help, hey, can't we just, you know, if we were just to love our neighbor in a practical way, how could we change the world? You know, instead of the disagreements over, you know, everything we want to disagree about theologically, we just said, you know, the one thing we can't really argue is that Jesus said, love one another. How are we doing that? And if we do it, then the results speak for themselves. They change people's lives.
Amen. All right, friends, we got to take a quick break, but Craig and I are going to continue this conversation, so stick with me. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith.
So speak now.
Hey, friends. Welcome back. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined by Craig Strickland. Craig is the founding pastor of Hope Church Memphis. But what he would really want you to know about today is what he's working on with Echo Clinics. And he wants you to check it out at Echo, E-C-H-O, clinics.org. Craig, what is Echo Clinics and why is this the greatest opportunity in healthcare for the poor that exists today?
Well, in a nutshell, Carmen, what we do is we go to a city and help a group of churches start a health clinic for the poor that's faith-based. And with healthcare in our country the way it is, the people that get hurt the worst every time are poor people. There's a man here in Memphis named Scott Morris. He's a Methodist minister and a medical doctor. And 35 years ago, he moved to Memphis from Atlanta without knowing a soul. He had finished his medical degree and his MDiv degree. And he moved here to start a health clinic. And he joined the staff of a Methodist church as an associate. And they rented him a building, a house across the street from the church for a dollar a year. A dollar a year. And he took that building, and there was the church was a pretty liberal church. A very evangelical church came along and said, we'll renovate that house for you. And they spent a bunch of money renovating the house. And then a Jewish synagogue came along and said, well, you know what? We see what others have done. We'll pay salaries for the first year. Their first day, they had 13 patients. Today, they have more than 50,000 patients. They're the largest church health clinic of its type in the country. And Scott Morris, who is my friend that started that clinic, came to me a couple of years ago and said, it's time for us to replicate this across the country because we're only helping people in this region. And there is this unlimited resource pool in the local church of people that are doctors, nurses, but just volunteers that say, please use me. And we need to find a way to put them to work. And Church Health has probably 1,000 churches that are involved, thousands and thousands of volunteers, and doctors that all over the city that have volunteered a day a month or some period of time where they have said, I'll come down there and work for the day. Just don't make me do the paperwork and all the stuff I get stuck doing. And he says, I'll make that happen. And when he first started, doctors of all kinds would come down and volunteer a day a month. One was a surgeon who was just doing family medicine with Scott, seeing patients one day. And he comes out to Scott and says, I've just seen this lady who has a huge tumor, and it needs to be surgically removed. And Scott said, well, let me take a look at it. And Scott came back out and said, you're right, she does have a huge mass. And he says, but it doesn't really need an operation. She's pregnant. It's a baby. Well, this guy's a surgeon, you know. He's not used to thinking in those
Everything's
terms.
A tumor.
Yeah. And so they realized the best thing. This surgeon said, look, why don't you just send me somebody that needs an operation? I'll operate for free. I'll do that for you twice a month or whatever. And so Church Health was born. It's been hugely successful. And when we began replicating this model 18 months ago, it was with a short-term grant that we would build 6 charter clinics in 3 years. We're 18 months in. The 6 charter clinics are well on their way, and there are 6 behind them. And when we execute on all 6 of those clinics, we then are looking to scale the ministry to 150 clinics in 10 years. And so what I do is I go to cities all over the country and meet with clergy. And what I love to do is talk to just one pastor in a city, and I ask him, can you get 4 or 5 guys together, men or women, doesn't matter to me what denomination, just 4 or 5 people. And if you've got a ministerial association, it's got a bunch of people, that's great, but doesn't have to be that. And I will come tell you how to start that clinic. And if you want to be a part of it, we will hold your hand for the 18 months that it takes to get that clinic built, and we will show you how to hire the staff. We'll build a five-day-a-week full-time clinic, and you will change the lives of people that are underinsured and uninsured in your community. And hospitals usually love us because poor people, when they get sick, they go to the emergency room. They get the flu, they go to the emergency room. And so our emergency rooms are clogged with poor people that can't afford to go anywhere else. And tragically, even though they get helped in the emergency room, next time they get sick, guess where they go? Right back to the emergency room. And so hospitals can't free up the space that they need for real emergencies. And in our model, we encourage them when somebody comes in with a non-emergent problem to send them to the health clinic. And when they leave the health clinic, they leave having been treated, and they leave with the name of a doctor who now is their doctor. And that's happening all over the country, and we're in the early stages of it, but looking for the opportunities to begin scaling it now. And what I would love more than anything in the world are people that are interested in understanding that literally a third of the gospel is about the healing ministries. And yet when you look at the church's ministry, a third of their ministry is not about healing. Why not? The reason is not a theological reason. The reason is a pragmatic reason. It is very complicated to start a health clinic that has regulations that are federal, local, medical, you know, they run the gamut. We know how to do all that. Mm-hmm. We've been doing, we've done 70 clinics. We know how to do it. And so love to have you reach out to us at echoclinics.org or send me an email at cstrickland@echoclinics.org. And I'd be glad to connect with you and meet with you about how we can make this happen in your city.
All right, friends. So the website is echoclinics.org. You can send Craig a direct email. I can't believe you just gave it out on radio, but okay. cstrickland@echoclinics.org. Friends, we're serious. We want you to mobilize your church to begin to do what we're called to do. And in this way, if you've sat around, you know, grumbling and wondering how to make a difference in your city, in your community, related to health care, particularly in relationship to the poor, look, it's not that there's just a model that exists. There's like real help, real hands-on help and partnership that exists. You should definitely go to the website and check it out, echoclinics.org. Really, all of the information is aggregated there on the website, and it's really simple to use. People can, you know, they can learn not only about Echo, but they can learn about starting a charitable clinic, expanding an existing clinic, check out the resources that are already available, and then there's a whole list of ways to help. And so, friends, we really want to encourage you. Like, God has put you where He has put you on purpose and for a purpose for such a time as this. And part of that ministry calling is that you would mobilize the resources that are within your reach. And for most of us, there are resources within reach that are currently underutilized in terms of kingdom advancement. And particularly on this forefront, healthcare for the poor, most of us have within our congregations men and women with all kinds of medical talent, skills, and abilities. And particularly among retired people in the medical field. This is a great opportunity for you to engage in an ongoing ministry that's really relevant. Hey, Craig Strickland, thank you for joining us today on Connecting Faith. Friends, we're out of time today, but you can always visit me online at myfaithradio.com. Connecting Faith has a page there, or you can visit my ministry website, reconnectwithcarmen.com. I'll see you right back here tomorrow. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is Connecting Faith. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.